Hello and welcome to Wheelhouse Arts Art by Volume, presented by The Wine Room by J. Bell Wine Co., the 100 proof podcast that highlights the vibrant voices of Louisville's creative community. I'm your host, Robin Elise Gibson, aka RAG or RAG, if you feel so inclined, and this series shines a spotlight on the diverse range of creatives and aficionados from our beautiful visual arts community. From emerging artists and seasoned curators to passionate collectors and innovative designers, each episode explores the unique journey, insights, and stories that define their craft. In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with local curator Dr. Fari Nzinga. As Black women from and or currently residing in West End Louisville, we discussed the importance of community building and support, the power of narrative and telling our own stories, and utilizing the resources we have access to. We also discussed the G.C. Cox Exhibition, part of the ongoing series, Louisville's Black Avant-Garde at the Speed Art Museum, on view now through September 7th. All this and more on this episode 2 of Art by Volume. Every conversation is paired with a thoughtfully curated drink from our sponsor and neighbor, The Wine Room by J. Bell Wine Co., reflecting the artful vibe of the discussions. In this episode, my guest and I will be enjoying The Wine Room Summer Pick, a 2024 Rosé of Sangiovese. This 2024 Rosé of Sangiovese is your new favorite summer sipper. Fruity, flirty, and undeniably fun. Sourced from the iconic Red Willow Vineyard in Washington State, this rosé showcases the vibrancy and elegance that comes from one of the region's most respected sites. Known for its calcareous volcanic soils, Red Willow lends a distinct minerality and structure that elevate this wine beyond your average pink pour. Made entirely in stainless steel to preserve its crisp freshness and vibrant character, this wine bursts with lively notes of peach, strawberry, and tart cherry. The Sangiovese grape shines with its signature bright acidity and mouth-watering finish, making each sip refreshing and expressive. On the nose, you'll find delicate florals and red berry aromas. The palate is clean and juicy, with a zesty edge that's perfect for pairing with citrus marinated grilled chicken, fresh summer salad, or simply sipping poolside. Bright, balanced, and easy drinking, this wine is a celebration of summer in a glass, proof that serious wine can still be seriously fun. ABV is more than just a podcast. It's a celebration of creativity, expression, and the art that connects us all. So, grab a glass and tune in as we turn up the volume on the conversations that matter in the art world. And get us started. Hello, Dr. Fari Nzinga.
Hi.
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this episode with us. Yes. So actually the first time
anybody mentioned you to me was actually another curator friend of mine. I don't know if I told you this. It was definitely in my mind, so I could have definitely forgotten about it. But my friend Mike works at the Frist Museum in Nashville.
That's right.
And just kind of told me that you guys were collaborating at one point, which I just thought was really cool. And that was another reason why I was like, yeah, I really want to meet this person.
What a small world. That's yes. So great. Thank you very much for inviting me to be here and yes. reaching out. This is so wonderful, and I've really enjoyed meeting you.
Yes, I've enjoyed our conversation so far as well. And before we kind of get into, you know, the art of it, I kind of just wanted to get to know you just a little bit better. So if you don't mind sharing with us your art story and kind of your migration story, because you're not a Louisville native, but you are here now and you called us your home and we're happy to have you. So if you don't mind, it doesn't have to be, you know, elaborate, but kind of just the how you kind of got here and
sure.
what drew you to art in the first place.
Thank you. Well, I had a really fancy maternal grandmother who was a member of different art museums in the city of Boston, where I was born and where I grew up. Her name was Irma B. Brooks. And so she used to always take me and my mom to different art exhibitions and openings. She had a small, very modest collection of work herself and was friends with artists and was kind of just an enthusiast and a supporter and a lover of Black creative people. So, but she also took me to the opera when I was 16 as my big birthday present, That's you know, cool. in New York City. So, like I said, she is my fancy grandmother. And even though we loved enjoying art together, I don't know that it clicked in my mind that I thought, oh yes, I could pursue this mm-hmm. professionally when I grow up. I just adored hearing her stories about traveling and seeing art, you know, and she said she went to see Michelangelo's David, and she was just like, oh, David, David. You know, she was so dramatic, probably because she was a fan of the opera. You know, you have to be a certain amount of a diva to enjoy and appreciate that art form. So I grew up surrounded by creative Black people and artists. My childhood bestie, her dad is Paul Goodnight, who is a very esteemed African-American artist. And some people know him most popularly because his work was in the home of the Banks family in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Okay.
But, you know, outside of that, he is just so renowned and acclaimed and has achieved so much as a Black artist. Yeah, I just was surrounded by really creative people and always wanted to be around them. I went to Oberlin for college, another stronghold of the arts, and so lots of my friends were students at the Conservatory of Music, and I loved to sit in on their jam sessions and always attend their concerts and recitals. And so that was another way that I was really into the arts more broadly. I don't know. I really got started looking at the arts seriously and artists in particular around after 2005. I graduated from Oberlin in 2005. Mm-hmm. And then and you can edit this part out, just blur the dates, you know what I'm saying? I graduated from college and I went to live on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota for a bit while I figured out my next move. And during that time, Hurricane Katrina happened, and it was such a shocking and appalling and radicalizing experience for me and for many others. And so when I eventually started attending Duke University for grad school in cultural anthropology, I just knew that I wanted to go and understand what was happening and how the Black people there were doing. Mm-hmm. And I knew that anthropology was my kind of disciplinary home because I wanted to get that information straight from the people. I didn't want to go and spend all my time in the archives or, you know, in the library. I wanted to be out doing things right. and experiencing the types of cultural production that was happening and. So naturally I kind of fell in with this very artistic Black young crowd, and everyone was doing everything. You know, there were dancers and filmmakers and photographers and visual artists and poets. Team Snow was huge, you know, like I was never a big poetry person, but getting to see the wonderful Sunny Patterson perform in person, I was like, oh my God. So everything they were doing, I just was like, this is so important and more people need to understand what's happening here and know what's going on and look at the art and experience it and listen to it and hear it and really be immersed in it to understand why this place is so important and, you know, what the stakes are for bringing New Orleans back, right. quote unquote, after this terrible catastrophe had happened. And I started working with a group of older Black folks who were really invested in preserving history and their specific, you know, like family legacies, genealogy, and material culture. And so they were trying to organize a museum, and they were running into all of these issues in terms of lack of access to resources. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of seized upon me as this young person who was in this professionalizing journey. And I was like, yes, I'm here to serve and learn. And so I just soaked it all up. And after that was like, well, yeah, museums are really important places where culture is mediated and discourse is, you know, originating and circulating and, you know, meaning
right.
is what's the name of the game here. And that's always been really interesting to me.
Natalie O Design is a full-service studio that offers a highly developed suite of expertise and services specializing in residential remodels, new construction, and commercial projects. They approach each project holistically and with keen attention to artful details. Their team will be beside you from start to finish, from selecting your build team to choosing tailor-made finishing touches. At Natalie O Design, they lead with craft and innovation. For two decades, their team has pushed boundaries and norms within commercial, hospitality, and residential interior projects, challenging conventions with their embrace of adaptive reuse and in-house designed furniture, lighting, art, textiles, and tile. They think globally, with references informed by international travel, food culture, and art, while acting locally with headquarters in Louisville, Kentucky. They are a proud megaphone for local and regional creative talent, makers and artists with whom they collaborate to create spaces that are notable for their eclecticism, warmth, and soul. Allow them to bring your vision to light.
So that's kind of where I started out. And then when I couldn't quite get a stronghold in the museum realm, I was like, well, what? Like, it's hard. Like, you just organize an art show because you know artists and they need to build their audiences. So I started curating. Right. And in 2018, right before I left New Orleans, after having spent almost a decade there, I did an exhibition called The Rent Is Too Damn High, which is actually, it was the, what do you call it, like the slogan that the city council person was running on in New York a couple years prior. And he did it in this really classy way. He like always wore a top hat and coattails and, you know, was this very dignified Black man of labor who was just like, I don't care what the political apparatus thinks the talking points are that are going to move the needle on the polling. The people of New York deserve to know what is going to happen to help them, you know, remain in their homes and live good lives. And so he was like, what's the thing that we can all agree upon? It's that the rent is too damn high.
Right.
And so in 2018, when New Orleans was turning 300 and they were, you know, all these different campaigns, mm-hmm. you know, media and publicity campaigns to bring more tourism and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I was like, but the real story here is that the rent is too damn high, right. and you wouldn't have 300 years of nothing that nobody wanted to see and experience if it weren't for the Black people that were forcibly brought here
right.
and who made the cuisine you love to enjoy
right.
and who built the built environment and the architecture that you love to, you know, photograph and study and call quaint and romantic,
right.
the music that you love to dance to. The visual art that you love to see,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Black masking Indian traditions and the social aid and pleasure clubs, the skull and bones gang and the baby dolls,
mm-hmm.
like all of these wonderful moments of cultural efflorescence, if you will, are coming straight out of the Black experience
right.
in New Orleans.
Right.
And at 300 years, the least you can do is say, I see you. Thank you.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the animus behind organizing this exhibition and creating an opportunity and a platform to have meaningful conversations about what was going on in New Orleans from the perspective of Black creative young people
right.
who are trying to raise families, be part of their, you know, families' legacies. Like, you know, we were in our 30s at the time, so we were trying to figure it all out, and we were trying to be adults, and
right.
we were trying to be, you know, that generation that was going to be handed the baton and that was going to steward that and hand it off to the next generation. So what does that look like to do that responsibly and sustainably and creatively? So that's what that exhibition was about, and it was totally wonderful, amazing experience. I mean, I had to figure out the venue, I had to figure out the marketing, I had to figure out how to get the art from point A to point B. I mean, I was just doing all the different things, and in the end, it was a success because the community of people that I was a part of wanted it to be a success
right.
and supported my vision and lent their talents to this greater conversation that we were trying to have. And so I'm just so thankful for that opportunity. After that, I moved to Michigan and I worked in a museum where I had a joint appointment where I worked at a museum and I also taught at a liberal arts college
okay.
in the art history department.
Okay.
And the whole point was to use the museum's collection
resources.
And resources to build the curriculum, which I had such an amazing time doing. Shout out to Kalamazoo, Michigan. I taught at Kea College and I worked in the curatorial department at the Kalamazoo Institute of Art. I had the wonderful opportunity to be there and learn and help when we mounted a traveling exhibition of the Studio Museum in Harlem's mm-hmm. permanent collection. And so that was an amazing experience learning about their collection and their institutional history and just feeling like, yes, there was so much energy and momentum that I had witnessed in New Orleans and have been a part of. And I'm like, yes, this is part of
right.
what we have done
right.
as a people over time, which is we get together, we come together, and we make it happen
right.
because ain't nobody giving nothing out here. And in fact, people are actively trying to take from us.
Yes.
So that was really fortifying as I went into these, you know, predominantly white institutions to have that experience and that sense of rootedness and, you know, importance. I was always very clear about the why
mm-hmm.
of what I've been doing as a curator, as an educator,
mm-hmm.
as a researcher and a scholar and a writer and a thinker, you know, like that's what I'm into. So, so I've worked in museums. I've worked in higher education. I absolutely adore teaching, although I don't know if I want to go back into the classroom, but you did not ask me that. So we'll just keep it moving.
It's fair.
And most recently I was working here at the Speed Art Museum, and I had the wonderful opportunity to really be in community with and learn from and learn with the Black folks here in terms of how they've been preserving the legacy of the important artists that came before in the city and that created space for all artists of all colors to be able to show work outside of the museum, outside of, you know, the traditional commercial gallery circuit. And so that has been my joy. That has been my purpose and my calling. I live in the West End. I have an amazing partner. Shout out to Jason Kyle McAfee and our beautiful daughter, Ilu Jaya. The McAfees have been holding me down. Nice. I am just so, so thankful that I have them as this wonderful anchor in the West End here in Louisville. And I am just really thankful to be able to uplift the history and the culture and do that in a time when it's really important for us to tell our own stories and to pass along our history and our culture and our traditions and just our ways of being in the world. Our collective spirit is more important now than it has ever been. And I am so, 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 so grateful to be a part of that Black collective and to try to, you know, bring those stories to the forefront. So I can't wait to hear you tell me more about your thinking behind when you went to see the show on G.C. Cox that is up now at the Speed.
Yes.
That is the third of a series of shows that I curated, each spotlighting a local Black male artist who helped to integrate University of Louisville when they first began to admit Black students and were some of the first African-American students to come through the Height Art Department here.
That's so, actually part of my legacy as well.
So yes.
That's where I graduated.
That's right. From. That is right. Yes.
So, and actually you've hit on quite a few things. I do want to say one of the things that you like just said about, you know, us basically taking control of our histories and making sure that, you know, the stories are told and preserved and shared, and the importance of that, because I didn't know about these artists until recently, until, you know, these the series of shows have come through the Speed, and then talking with you a little bit more and diving a little bit deeper and seeing just how much I didn't know. And it's crazy to me because I am part of the legacy, but still so ignorant of, you know, the actual history and what that looks like and what that means. Because when you're in art school, especially as a Black woman, at a PWI anyway, it already feels like you're kind of alone. And because it's, you're one of a few. Or when I went to grad school, I was the only Black person in my class. So it can be very isolating. And so to know that you have this lineage that, you know, just kind of surrounds you is like, wow. And it opens you up, and it makes you appreciate just a little bit more your own journey and what you're a part of. So I'm like personally just thankful for the work that you and the Speed have done to like push that into the forefront, to have people to see and to digest and to understand just how, you know, big and amazing that is. And it's just like there was a term that you said at some point when we were talking, it was grassroots art history. And I just thought that that was so powerful because that is exactly what it is. And that's the legacy that you've been, you know, going through since you've been on your curatorial journey. You've been working directly with the artists, with the people, with the community to tell the story as it is, rather than, you know, editing it for the purposes of whatever purpose, and being bold enough to say, hey, we need our space. We're going to make the space to do it. And then when you are in spaces that are lending, like predominantly white spaces that are, you know, opening up for us to be in the space, you're not only just bringing, you know, the knowledge that you have for that period, but you're bringing all of this past knowledge, and it's like you're bringing all of us with you into these spaces. So that's also very powerful as
Thank
well.
You.
So, yes.
I'm just following in the tradition of Black feminists that have come before me.
Yes.
I mean, we have a long, long, long lineage that we inherit, and we have so many giants that we stand on their shoulders. So
yes.
Thank you for recognizing that.
And it's, because we often say or use the terminology, you know, we are part of this legacy, this lineage. Sometimes after you hear it so many times, it's like, oh, you know, but once you really come down to it and you understand what that means and what that looks like, it just hits you in a different way. And so, especially as you get closer to it, you know, as you get to know the people rather than just the legacy. So getting to know, even if you can't meet the artists themselves, meeting their family, their friends, becoming part of their community, understanding what it means, walking where they walked in the city, you know, seeing the things that got them inspired, being inspired by those things. So it's really, really nice to have that as part of the conversation as well. So talking about the GC Cox show, I had a few pieces that stood out to me, and of course I meant to write down the titles, but I forgot to
That's
do
okay.
That.
Describe them and I'll see if I can remember.
So my favorite one, and it's not necessarily, I think it's the reason why it's my favorite is because of where I am right now in my own life and
artistic
journey.
Don't qualify it. Just tell me what your favorite is. No one's judging. We're all friends here.
True, true. It's the Black on Black piece.
Oh,
I
yes.
love that piece.
That's called, I think, Blues in Black, and I believe it was done in 1968 or 69. I want to give a shout out to William M. Duffy and Sherry Duffy and their wonderful daughter, Kristen Harris, who are the owners and keepers of that piece, and they lent it to be shared with the museum audience for this exhibition.
Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
From me
you.
As well, because
thank
that
you.
Piece is, it is something that one inspires me to continue on a journey that I want to take in my own artwork, working Black on Black and kind of seeing what that means for me as I continue on and kind of experiment and see how I can make it work. But also, it wasn't just the imagery for me, because it does feel to me like a figure. But I see figures everywhere, so literally. But it was also the texture on texture, the way that you can move in any direction and it changes. And I just think that the simplicity of it, as well as that extra added complexity, just marries it very well to the point where you get something different out of it wherever you stand. And it's a tall piece, it feels portrait, it already makes me feel like I'm relating it to my body. So it's something that I like to just kind of look at and experience. So yeah, that was my favorite piece, but there are other pieces in the show that I just thought were, well, the whole show is amazing, honestly, but that stood out to me. And a few of them were like, as you're walking, I guess they're more sculptural. It's next to the piece that was the saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mm-hmm. like that back wall, that corner mm-hmm. there. And I went with Daniel and we were just talking about it. And it's like, these feel like they could have been like on TV. And it's funny that you mentioned the works that were in The Fresh Prince, because I was also thinking about like The Cosby Show and A Different World. And it's just like the vibrant colors of the time and the play with texture and pattern just made me think of that. And it just put me in a very real space of, you know, even what I experienced as a kid in the 90s, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it was like a fun and like comforting, but also it felt very experimental, but it just felt playful. And it was really cool to be in that part of the space as well. But contrasting that with different moods as you move through the entirety, but as whimsical and as playful as everything felt, there was also a lot of sophistication that kept me grounded in a way and made me, you know, keep thinking, what is it that I'm seeing? What is it that I'm experiencing? What is it that's being communicated? Because these works are mainly, you know, abstract. So it's got me in that space of thinking, you know, what am I feeling right now?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a very well put together show, and just the way that everything moved, the sculptural aspects, the flatness, things on like the canvas as sculpture, all of that was just like, he was really working through a lot of things and not afraid right. to just do it.
And that was just such a small snippet of his overall output.
Mm-hmm.
So G.C. Cox was born in 1908 in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. His mom was actually an Oberlin alum, so get a shout out there, because I also am an Oberlin alum. So I was like, yes, girl, I knew there was something special connecting me. And his father was a Presbyterian minister, and so they were a bit itinerant in terms of following the father who pastored at different churches throughout the South. One anecdote that I found about him in my research was that before his family moved to Louisville, Kentucky, they were in North Carolina. And the artist in an interview talked about traveling with his dad somewhere and stumbling upon a lynch mob mm-hmm. who had actually just murdered someone.
Wow.
And in front of that mob, his G.C. Cox's father cuts the man down. You know, he's like, I'm not going to let him just fucking swing here.
Right.
You know, he's a person. He deserves dignity. And of course, people were not happy with that.
Yeah.
But the amazing strength of character to be able to do that with your young son right there, you don't know. Yeah, you're maybe trying to be an example, but as a parent, you're actually just trying to keep your kid alive.
Yeah.
So, you know, the strength and the backbone that took to be able to know and have the faith that, yes, I'm going to do this action and it's not going to be met with, you know, kindness or generosity, but God has me, God has my kid, and this is what is right and this is what must be done.
Right.
You know, to have that as a memory that so at such a young age, because by the time GC and his family moved to Louisville, he was still young enough to attend high school.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to Central, which at the time was called Central Colored High. And I think he graduated in like 1929. So right as he's going off into the world, we know there's a huge stock market crash in the United States, which then sends the U.S. and the rest of the world, frankly, into the Great Depression. And that is his young adulthood.
Right.
That is the lay of the land as he's expected to go out and become the head of his own household.
Right.
He always knew that he was artsy, and everyone always knew that he was artsy. So it was never a question of trying to go through these different channels to figure out how to make money and then how to make art as well. He, from the jump, was like, this is what it's going to be. His father, being a Presbyterian minister, was actually friends with another famous Presbyterian minister, whose name, of course, escapes me at this moment, but I'm seeing a picture of him in my mind. This black minister was so important because he was one of the first and only black missionaries to Africa. He was in the then Belgian Congo and was accepted by all of the people, not just the regular people, but also by the royal court, the indigenous rulers of that area. And so he was able to move about very freely in a time when black people were not able to move about freely anywhere in any context.
Right.
And he recorded and took pictures of and helped to break an international story that would be published in the New York Times that outlined the horrors of the Congo that they were suffering under the Belgian ruler, King Leopold. And, you know, that led to sanctions on the world scale, stage, and et cetera, right? So this black man with a conscience working for a white institution in the Presbyterian Church still figures out how to, you know, fulfill his God-given purpose, which is to uplift and to be in community with black people. So he also ends up in Louisville, Kentucky. He's friends with G.C. Cox's dad, and he had collected and acquired this huge collection of art and material culture from his time in the Congo. G.C. Cox is growing up with that stuff all around him.
Wow.
You know, those Kuba blankets and the different wood carvings,
yes,
and just a totally different aesthetic sensibility. And he's kind of, I don't know, integrating that into his own worldview as an African American. His mom, he called a seamstress and an artist with a needle. His dad, even though he was a minister, was also a woodworker and a carpenter and a painter himself. And so both of GC's parents are pouring into him all of the love for art and all of the actual techniques of making art, in addition to him being surrounded by this Cuba art and material culture. So, you know, he graduates. It's the Great Depression. He opens up a shop. He, like, paints signs, and he designs storefront window displays, and he builds set pieces for the different African-American theater companies here in Louisville. And that's how he kind of starts out. And then ultimately, he gets a job at Fort Knox, where he is a technical illustrator. So all of the machinery and equipment that they use, he's drawing it to scale for the instruction manual.
Right.
So they have to be able to be very exact.
Yes.
And the lines and the geometry and the cleanliness of the image, the realism of the image, it's all there, the precision. It's all there. He's doing this job for like 20 years, probably longer. And at the same time, working in his studio that he made, you know, these different ways of storing his work and sharing studio space with other people. One of the other stories that I love about him, learning about him, is that he goes back to school at like 47. And he finally is able to go to art school at the University of Louisville. He is one of the first black students to get a Height Art Scholarship at
the ripe age of 47, and people are like, oh, you know, it's so great and blah, 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 right? Like, those who don't know, don't know. Mm-hmm. And I started to do the math, and I'm like, wait, he was only in the second, maybe first, second, or third desegregated class at U of L. He went back because he knew he could finally get in. They weren't accepting black students when he graduated in 1929 or whatever. So he had to wait 15 more years, 17 more years, whatever, you know, that span was. And in the meantime, he had to figure out how to feed himself and how to still, you know, explore his craft and what he felt was his God-given talent and skill and calling. So I just think that's so important because he is not someone who exists in a vacuum. He's a human person who's responding to the real life big H history that's happening in his lifetime and immediately in the places where he lives. And to make this art and to be so precious about it and to really treat it seriously as, you know, the discipline that it deserves, he, you know, took on this role as a secondary educator for so many of his classmates that were like 20 years younger than him.
It's also just so amazing to hear and have him as an example, like, of the world that we're living in right now.
Right.
With the lack of resources that just keep on draining. Girl. The fact that, you know, going through a recessive and depressive, you know, economic space where we are now, and seeing how he survived that and thrived through it, it's very encouraging, especially as an artist, because you're thinking, what should I be doing right now?
Right.
And how am I supposed to be surviving right now? There are so many questions. And just the fact that he just kept going, he just kept pressing and just kept doing what needed to be done at the time that it needed to be done. And so as you're talking about, you know, him doing professional work, very technical work, sign making, anything that he can do that's still creative, that's still allowing him to learn and hone his craft, and then being able to go to school when he has the opportunity to do so, and to teach others, because he's got all of this knowledge and all of this
life
information
experience and on-the-job training. And
exactly,
one of the things that I learned through an interview that Sarah Battle conducted, shout out to her, was that, after he graduated, he still frequently went back to the art library and just read as much as he could and talked to the different students that were hanging out there and the different professors that were hanging out there and the different art librarians. He was always interested in what else is going on and took it upon himself to stay educated in the things that he, you know, wanted to do and thought were important and that he cared about. And then, so that's really important, just putting yourself in the position of always having something to learn. Yes, you bring others into what you're doing and you teach them stuff, but then you yourself go out and seek more so that you can give that back.
This episode is sponsored by Wheelhouse Art, a contemporary art gallery whose mission is to make more art more accessible to more people. Located in Louisville, Kentucky's historic Crescent Hill neighborhood, Wheelhouse Art believes in the power of art to inspire, connect, and transform. Their exhibitions rotate every 6 weeks, showcasing incredible work by regional and national artists in a welcoming, approachable space that's free and open to the public. The Wine Room by J. Bell Wine Co. is proud to announce the opening of their newest tasting room in Louisville, Kentucky. A homecoming for their talented winemaker who was born and raised in this vibrant city. 6 years ago, she made the journey to Washington State to learn and craft wines for J. Bell, and now brings the heart of their winemaking philosophy back to her hometown.
As a family-owned boutique winery, Jay Bell is dedicated to small lot production and old world winemaking practices. Each bottle reflects their commitment to authenticity and craftsmanship, with a focus on single varietals and thoughtfully balanced blends. They embrace minimal intervention in the cellar, allowing their wines to speak for themselves. They use native yeast fermentation, and most of all, their wines are unfiltered and unfined, preserving their natural character and depth. This Louisville location not only celebrates their winemaker's roots, but also offers a new way to experience Jay Bell's Washington-grown wines in an intimate, community-driven setting. Whether you're a seasoned wine lover or new to the world of handcrafted wines, you're invited to taste the story behind every glass, where tradition, place, and passion meet. Welcome to The Wine Room by Jay Bell Wine Co. Louisville. This episode is brought to you by our friends at Indigo Mavens. The Indigo Mavens Interior Design Studio is on Lexington Road in the heart of St. Matthews. The Mavens bring a warm, client-centric approach to design, serving up joyful spaces that blend modern sensibilities while perfectly at home in the bluegrass. Their work is deeply personal, tailored to reflect not just how a space looks, but how it functions and feels. With a roster of talented local tradespeople, their client-centric approach turns every project into a collaborative experience focused on listening, guiding, and designing with intention. Whether you're taking on a full renovation or just refreshing your furnishings, Indigo Mavens can create a home that truly reflects you. Visit indigomavens.com or follow along on Instagram at Indigo Mavens. Indigo Mavens, creating beauty in the bluegrass every day.
And then the other major lesson that I learned through learning about his life is that it is all about the collective. Mm. The reason he was able to survive, the reason that his legacy has been upheld thus far, is because he squatted up, you know? Like, he wasn't the first and the only. He was one of the first, right. One of the only.
Right.
And so within that group of students, they decided to form a visual arts collective in the 1950s, right, in Louisville, right? They had just integrated U of L's art program, but the Speed Museum wasn't interested in their, you know, in their work. Mm-hmm. The galleries around town were not interested in representing them. Mm-hmm. What were they going to do? Did they go to art school for nothing? Mm-hmm. No. So they started a collective at the Brown Derby, and they talked to the owner of the bar, and they were like, hey, can we set up some space in the back? And the guy said, yeah. So they, like, redid the floors and painted the walls and put up some extra furniture, and they started hanging their art, and they made it such a vibe that later they actually were displaced from the bar because there were so many people, and they were like, we can't afford to give you this space anymore. Right. You know, they made it, their work was so impactful and important in that space. And so then they went to other spaces, and basically the same things, right, kept happening. So they're like really the linchpins, or at least very important engines of Black culture in Louisville at that time.
Right.
And so people like Sam Gilliam were part of the gallery enterprises, Robert L. Douglas, who is the artist that I did the first solo show for at the Speed. He was the founding directing faculty of the Pan-African Studies Department at U of L. People like Bob Thomas and Bob Carter and G.C. Cox, you know, they were all involved. There was one woman, give major shouts out to Eugenia V. Dunn, who was the one woman in the Gallery Enterprises Art Collective. But she was also an artist, and from Louisville, she had gotten her degree in biology and was a science professor down in Atlanta at Spelman. But she was always involved in the arts, even when she was in Atlanta, and then finally came back to Louisville and was like, I'm going to be an artist full time, right, and linked up with this, you know, group of guys. Her story goes off in another direction, but all that to say that GC Cox is like in this mix, you know? And so Sam Gilliam goes to DC, Kenneth Victor Young goes to DC, Bob Thompson goes to New York. You know, some years pass and some new blood comes in. Some young people are getting old enough. They want to be down. They start another collective, this time in the West End, out of somebody's house, a married couple, Anna Bond and her husband, Fred Bond. And they had a space where up front they made it so that you could put up exhibitions, and in the back it was their house where they raised their children. Wow. I love that.
Me too.
I love that so much.
It's like we need that.
So, you know, and then Fred Bond took it upon himself to go to the different high schools and just talk to the different teachers and see if he could get in the classrooms and tell them about Black artists and show them examples of Black artists' work. And this is where William M. Duffy comes into play, because he's like, Fred Bond came to my class.
Right.
And up to that point, Duffy said he thought he was the only Black artist there ever was, well, at least in Louisville, because he just didn't have those figures to look up to that were really given a major platform, until Fred Bond comes along and is like, let me show you this whole community of artists that I'm a part of that would love to support your work as a young up-and-coming Black artist. And GC Cox is part of that mix. He's, you know, he and Fred Bond and Anna Bond and Robert Douglas and all these other artists, they started the Louisville Art Workshop in Del Park Terrace. And, you know, they had classes and workshops. They did exhibitions. They hosted artwork from people outside of Louisville, as well as hosting shows of Louisville artists. This is where GC Cox gets his first exhibition, is with the Louisville Art Workshop. So it's like, oh, they're not going to give you a space?
We
don't need to ask them to give us anything.
Right.
All we need is some walls, and we can put the art up ourselves. Right. And that's what they did. And they had the kids running up and through. And this wasn't just for Black people. It was especially for Black people, but white people were part of it too. Right. And people of other races and ethnicities were also coming through, because to go back to your point about like how I'm bringing all these people into the space with me, that's what we do.
Right.
Not just Black women and Black feminists, but Black people who are collective minded, who know where we come from and who understand the stakes of what it takes to not just survive in this Babylon, but to thrive and to give our kids a future.
Right.
So they created this space and they created their own way to get the message out there and to continue to have a critique so that they can get the feedback they need to really, you know, experiment and try new things and see where their creativity took them. They created this infrastructure that in turn shifted what was available to every artist in Louisville, because they saw what was going on there and they were welcome to be a part of it. You know, it's like, it's not that black people are doing this only for us. We're doing it because we have to do it for us, but we have always been extroverted people. So if someone comes to us and says, I love what you're doing, how can I be down? We're not turning people away.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, you're an artist too, and you're not getting picked up by the local, you know, big wigs. Come on over here. We got space for you.
Right.
And so, you know, that happened. The Louisville Art Workshop was started in 1966, and it just was amazing. So my research has been really thanks to people like Robert Douglas, Ed Hamilton, the Duffys, Ken and Carol Clay, you know, these folks who have been really keeping the banner going,
right,
and moving the culture forward and stewarding that legacy, so that when an artist like yourself is like, oh, I need some extra support, or I want to find out more about my own historical and cultural context, they've got you.
Right.
You know, it's like, maybe this conversation hasn't reached a certain level to where everyone's familiar with it, but this community of people always knew,
right,
and always, you know, have been supporting different artists of different generations and mentoring and so forth. Like, right. And the impact is just so outsized, because many people have never heard of G.C. Cox, but they have heard of Sam Gilliam.
Right.
And Sam Gilliam came back as often as he could and always wanted to go straight to G.C.'s house and his workshop. What's he doing? What's he up to?
Right.
The questions that were coming up for you when you saw his work about how an artwork can speak to someone in 360 degrees, even if it's just on the wall.
Right.
Those are exactly the questions that Gilliam then takes up with his famous drape paintings. You can see the conversations in terms of the experimentalism, the aesthetics, and, you know, the change of perspective, the angles shifting,
right,
and who gets to be a viewer and who gets to participate and who is this for? Like, all of those questions are being discussed and engaged and, you know, thought about and acted upon, you know, by this group of artists who I think are just phenomenal. And I'm so thankful and honored and privileged that I have the opportunity to help share these stories, help inspire artists and just people.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to be an artist to feel inspired that somebody who grew up during Jim Crow,
right,
who graduated into adulthood, into the Great Depression, who, you know what I mean?
Right.
Who toiled as an artist for decades, never once getting the type of attention and renown and acclaim, market share, or compensation that he was due, you know? So he died in 1999, and he was making work up until the very end. I mean, some of those pieces you might have seen were done in like 1998.
Yeah.
So, it, you know, it's really special to be able to create an opportunity for his family members. Shouts out to Damian Journey, Brandon Journey, Bill and Jody Journey, who, you know, kept as much of the collection of his work as they could intact. Mm-hmm. And when nobody was asking questions or seemed to give two hoots about who this guy was, his art or whatever, they just held on to the work because they knew that their loved one and family member was brilliant and deserved the time. And one day people might ask about, and here they want to be able to share, you know, the importance and the
right,
meaning behind who this person was and his art. And so when I came knocking on the door, they were ready for me. So, you know, again, I really feel like the lessons that I am learning through my curatorial journey is really about not being afraid to be interdependent with your community,
yeah,
and not necessarily feeling like you have to go outside of your community in order to do the thing.
Right.
You know, of course, like you said earlier in the conversation, Black people, our communities worldwide are typically at the bottom of the social heap, are starved for resources, for capital, for, you know, we got food deserts, so literally starved, like
literally,
all the things, you know?
Yes.
And yet, and still we rise.
Yes.
Like, are we not some bad mamma jamma? You know,
literally.
Because at the end of the day, whether the speed wants to tell this story or not, it is the family members of the artists who have kept that legacy and stewarded it. It is their story to tell, and theirs alone. So I'm privileged, I'm honored, I'm lucky, I'm thankful that I'm able to be a part of this community and help tell this story and help share this story. And so I know I'm like so chatty, but I will wrap it up. But I was going for a walk a couple years ago, and I stumbled across Muhammad Ali's childhood home. And I'm like, what? I've been living within blocks of this oh my gosh. And, you know, of course he's such an inspirational figure, and not just because of his quote unquote success, but I would say more so because of the adversity that he faced.
Yes.
And the backbone and the discipline.
Yes.
I mean, he said, ain't no Viet Cong ever called me the N-word.
Right.
And you can go ahead and try to throw me in jail, but right. I'm not coming down from standing on business.
Right.
Okay? That is, if that's not the blueprint, I don't know what is.
Right.
So in my mind, I started calling myself the people's curator. I said, well, you know, I live in the neighborhood of the people's champ.
Right.
So I'm going to be the people's curator, because you've heard me tell my story every time I work with artists, every time I put an exhibition together or just do anything within my curatorial practice. I'm trying to do it for the collective. I'm trying to share that story. I'm trying to elevate the artists involved. I'm trying to, you know, bring more scholarship and critical thinking and critical close looking into it. I'm trying to do a lot of things with this vehicle,
right?
But in the end, it's about the collective. It is about telling the story so that we can make more better art, so that we can live more better lives.
Right.
And so I was just thinking about that, no big deal. Unfortunately, I am no longer with the Speed. I did not get a chance to leave on my own terms, but what has been beautiful to see and what has convinced me that indeed I must become the people's curator is that each of the family members of the artists, the different lenders and collectors, scholars, other museum folks like your friend Michael, you know, every time I share my research and I help to share this story, I am greeted with so much support and goodwill. And, you know, for folks to come to see the value that I bring and to say, well, you may not be with your former employer, but who cares? Because we still have work to do.
Right.
You know, we still have to tell this story,
right,
and we want to tell it with you.
Right.
That to me is like, well, how could you not be the people's curator? You know, like you have to go through something to find out whether the people fuck with you. Excuse my language. So, you know, I, again, I'm just coming back to this. I sound like a record player, but this feeling of thankfulness, gratitude. I feel privileged, honored, humbled, to be able to be in community, to be of service, and to help tell this story as a model for how we might do this work in other places, right, elsewhere, not just with the visual arts, but just in general. How do we take our little collections of posters or art or the letters and correspondences that we've sent, or, you know, the little postcards of the events that we've been to, all of this, what we would call ephemeral material, and help and hold on to it and steward it so that we can use that to help tell our stories,
right,
to ourselves,
yeah,
to our children, and, you know, to anyone else who would want to listen and
right,
share in that experience with us. So I'm just here to say thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm so thankful that you went to see the show, that it made you think and question.
Yes.
And it sounds like it was generative. And I think in the end, that is the mark of the best art, is that it makes you want to respond to it in some way with your own creativity, whether that's just thinking about it, asking questions, doing research, writing a poem.
Right.
Making a piece of art yourself, like whatever it is, you know, that's what art is meant to do. And we need it. We need it now more than ever.
Especially now. It is so inspiring to be in that space and to hear the stories and to know, you know, like I said before, how they were responding during the times that they were responding. Because so much of it mirrors what we're going through right now. And it is a beautiful sort of example of how we can take up the mantle and keep going without feeling so much fatigue or without thinking that, you know, we want to give up, you know? Because it's like, it's easy to ask the questions, so what, you know, so what I draw a picture or I can doodle or I do the, who cares? But to see how monumental and how much of an impact it has made just for me, even not knowing the whole story, you know, beforehand, and still having an impact on me because the people who taught me didn't know, whether they passed it on the knowledge right then or later on or however, I still carry that legacy, and I still
and you still have a right to go back and search for it and claim it,
right?
You know, whether they taught it to you in a lesson plan or not,
right?
It's yours,
right? And to know that and to have something to hold on to and be proud of, but not only just that, but use as fuel for my own journey.
Right.
Like, how can I be part of the legacy and in a way that is impactful for the people who come after me? And not just them, but the people I'm in community with now, the people that I want to support in real time, the artists who are making brilliant work, who's deserve to be on display, or even if it's not on display in that way, in the field of vision of the people who need them, because we all need each other's stories. Right. We need each other's collective love and attention and, you know, nurturing.
Yes.
And I think that's just pushing it even further into my, at least into my psyche, into my mind, how much community is needed, because I've been knowing this for a long time, but it's not really sunk in quite as much as it's sunken in during a time when we're literally being ripped apart, either individually, our minds constantly at war with what we see every day on our devices and on the news. People telling us that our lives don't matter. Right. And we literally have to shout it from the street.
Right.
Black lives matter.
Right.
And that's even met with right. disdain and question. Like, we're not saying that nobody else's lives matter, but it's historically been shown that our lives haven't mattered.
Right.
And so having to do that and doing that in a way that's really creative and beautiful and saying the things without saying them while saying them, like, all of it is so beautiful, and seeing how everybody can fit together, different strengths doing different things, you know, it's just so wonderful. And I'm glad that we were able to have this conversation, especially during this time, especially with our audience now, because this is the time where it's needed the most. And I'm so grateful to, because I didn't get to see the first two shows. And
quick plug, the catalogs for the first two shows are in the gift shop at the Speed Museum. So please do, if you're able, go pick up a copy, because we do not want these stories to be sitting in a box in a basement of an institution that isn't doing with them what we, you know, isn't sharing them widely the way that we want them to be shared. So please go ahead and feel free to pick up a copy.
Absolutely. It's like, I need a catalog from each show. I need to know, and I need to have those in my own library so I can refer back to them. And I'm hoping that other people do the same, because this is all of our history.
Yes.
It's not just Black history. Black history is history.
Right. Right.
So, and it's Louisville history. This is something that we can be proud of as people from Louisville who have been in Louisville their whole lives. Maybe you haven't been, but you're still a part of our community.
Right.
And absolutely.
And so, one thing I learned in the course of this research is that the folks who were part of the gallery enterprises collective in the 1950s, they were trying to raise some money to pay off their debts, right? They had, like, been buying art supplies on credit, basically, and now it's time to pay up. So they started this clothesline art show, which eventually grew into what we know today as the St. James Art Fair. So even the thing that you may have heard of that you didn't have any idea had any connection to Black people whatsoever. Right. Because what I've heard from just being a person that lives here is that Black participation in that art fair is very minimal. Yeah. And, you know, I don't have direct experience with that, but I understand what they're saying. Mm. Even that only came into existence because Black people did a thing.
Right.
So, you know, I'm just bowled over by this so many blatant acts of erasure. Because when Black people do a thing, it's usually everybody that benefits from it. And the level of like racist, anti-Black, pathological hatred is just so crazy, because it's like, you got a good thing out of it, but because a Black person also got a good thing out of it, that makes it all bad.
Right.
Okay.
Or literally, it's like, excuse me, you got a good thing out of it, so you decide to take it.
Right, and just remove the Black people from it.
Exactly, so that they can no longer get that good thing that
they got. They started it, exactly, but they ain't gonna finish it.
Right.
Thanks, y'all.
Right. And you see it over and over and over again in different spaces.
Right.
Just different spaces. It's just life. Oh my gosh. Anyway.
But it is. It is life. It is the reality that we've been given, and I think we just have to be really vocal about calling things how we see them.
Yes.
And not letting this like alternate reality that pathological racists have created for themselves, not accepting that as universal truth.
Right.
It is not.
Right.
It is not at all.
Right.
And so whatever stories people are putting out there, now is the time to be that much more critical about the information that you're receiving, where it's coming from,
right,
who are the messengers, what might their
motives be.
Yeah, exactly. What are their incentives? Who benefits from the telling of this story in this way at this time? Right. You know, all of that is really important. And, you know, that was something that I love to do in the classroom, is just to really use art as a way to have those kinds of conversations, use history, use culture as a way to sharpen up my students' minds and really get them to think and question. Yeah. And so I just hope and pray that, you know, someone like a G.C. Cox, who is so sharp, so inquisitive, and from what I understand, so funny and also playful. You know, so I love that that came out in the work, you know, so meticulous and about his craft, like didn't take bullshit, but also was a jokester.
The way that you were talking about him, his family, his background, you know, even just how he worked at his job, everything I could see in the work.
Right. And he was just like a mad scientist, genius guy. Like, I heard a story about how I think a part for his refrigerator went out. And he was like, I'll just make a new one. Like, what? There is an industrial whatever the hell apparatus that makes this one part. But you, without the industry backing you, you're like, I can figure this out. And he did. And he did.
Yes.
You know? Yes. And so it's just like, oh, my God. I loved curating this show. I loved working with the artist family, learning more, going through all the archives, all the interviews I could find, and really getting a chance to get to know this person. And I felt like it was such a loss that we hadn't already heard of him, and that we hadn't already seen clips, and we hadn't already, you know, been familiarized with the anecdotes. Because when these spaces gatekeep us out of them, everybody loses.
Yes.
Everybody loses.
Yes.
Not just Black people, all the people.
It's so counter. It logic. It doesn't make sense to me. It never makes sense to me, because of the fact that when you're sharing these stories, you're sharing a soul that feeds other souls, including your own. But because of you can't get out of your own way.
Right.
Because you want to stay stagnant in your ignorance, you you don't get to benefit from that soul. You don't get to experience the beauty that's there for you too. Mm-hmm. It's not just there for us as Black folks. It's there for you too, as an individual who hates Black folks. And it's so sad.
It's so sad. And especially because so many people would never actually admit that they hate Black people. I mean, they don't even think they do hate Black people. So, you know, this is just a pathology. This is not, you know, they need professional help. So, but our point here is to say, we call it what it is. That's pathological bullshit. Y'all need to go handle that. We're going to be over here in the realm of reality, dealing with things as adults should. And we're going to keep building because we have no choice but to do otherwise, you know?
Absolutely. Yes, yes.
Hey, fashion lovers. Have you heard? One of Louisville's most beloved boutiques just made shopping smarter and easier. Margaret's Fine Consignments, a local favorite since 1991, has just launched their brand new website. Now you can browse their thoughtfully curated collection of pre-owned designer pieces, from Anthropologie and Free People to Lilly Pulitzer and Lululemon, all from the comfort of your own home. Whether you're after timeless classics or trendy finds, the new online store makes it simple to shop by brand or size and support sustainable fashion while you do it. So why wait? Visit margaretsconsignment.com. to shop smart, shop sustainably, and shop local. And if you're in town, stop by the store at 2700 Frankfort Avenue, open 7 days a week. The Wine Room by J. Bell Wine Co. in Louisville is more than just a tasting destination. It's a full sensory experience. In addition to their curated wine tasting experiences and the by the glass or bottle service, they're excited to offer a thoughtfully crafted small bites menu from their in-house chef. Designed to complement their old world style wine, the menu features locally sourced seasonal ingredients that highlight flavors that enhance the nuances of each pour. Inside, guests can enjoy guided tasting experiences in a dedicated space where reservations are encouraged, though they gladly welcome walk-ins if space allows. For a more relaxed vibe, their expansive outdoor patio offers the perfect setting to sit and savor with friends while taking in the charm of Frankfort Avenue. The patio is reserved for by the glass or bottle service, providing a laid-back atmosphere ideal for lingering over a favorite wine and a few delicious bites. Whether you're a seasoned wine enthusiast or just discovering J. Bell Wine Co., the Wine Room invites you to explore their wines, enjoy locally inspired fare, and connect with the heart of their winemaking story, all in a warm, welcoming Louisville setting.
I am feeling our conversation and kind of flashing back just to the show itself and just feeling how everything's kind of weaving together. And I'm really loving that about this conversation. But yes, okay, so before we wrap up, I do have two more questions for you. One of them is, I just kind of wanted to talk about your experience as a mother and as a professional and how you kind of, you know, balance the two of those. And I know community plays a major part in that because you did share that with me already. But I do also just want to hear from you about that because it's been a fairly new experience for you. And also, what else besides, you know, your career and art in particular brings you joy?
Thank you for allowing me to talk about these things before we wrap up so that I can end on just a really
brilliant, shining note.
Yes.
Thank you. When I first moved to Louisville, I was coming from Berea, Kentucky, where I was teaching at Berea College. And my partner is from here. When I got the job at The Speed, I almost immediately also found out that I was pregnant. And so I was like, oh, crap. You know, like, I just got this job. It's hard enough for these institutions to open their doors to Black people. I know they're going to be mad when they find out, you know. To their credit, they weren't mad. And one of the things that was so wonderful was that I was immediately thrust into this community, you know, with Ed Hamilton and William and Sherry Duffy and the Clays and the Douglases and, you know, these amazing luminaries in our city. And they were just so kind and welcoming. You know, I was moderating a panel and I'm like, you know, got my baby bump going on. And some folks I haven't kept in touch with as much, but then when I see them, they're like, oh, how's your baby? Like, I remember you were pregnant or you had just had a baby. As soon as they came back from maternity leave, which is not enough time. I mean, I don't even think you can buy a puppy that is as young as my baby was when I had to take her to daycare so that I could go back to work.
It's insane.
So we need a stronger labor movement because parental leave needs to be much longer than that. I just was like, well, she's coming with me. What else can I do? She's so tiny and I'm not leaving her places, but I have work to do. And I don't have a choice. I have income to earn, you know? So her first flight was at 4 months old. Every event that we had, every collection visit at someone's house, she was coming with. I'm so, so grateful to the Duffies. Every time I went over there, they're asking me about her. They said, please bring her. I brought her to one collection visit in particular that was so great because they were fighting over who could hold the baby. She eventually got, you know, time with both Mr. and Mrs. Duffy, and I got the photos to prove it. And every time I would go over there, they would have a little something set aside for me to bring back to her, some toys or some treat or just some beautiful token of our community-ness together. So I'm just so grateful for that. And, you know, as the project grew and expanded and included all these more people, she was up in the mix too, my girl, you know, and now she's 2 and a half almost, and she's running around and making her voice heard. And what's so beautiful is that we had a convening of project stakeholders that brought together like maybe 40 different people from around the country. And another young couple had a kid who's like a couple months younger than she is. And the two of them were just thick as thieves. I mean, the little videos and photos that came out of their little hijinks together, it's like, it's so beautiful. And it is such an authentic experience of community, right? Because we have the elders and we have the babies. The circle is complete. So that has been just such a wonderful way to enter into community for me, someone who's not from here, who didn't have deep roots before I got here. And, you know, it's been very challenging. It's been very challenging. The lack of sleep, I could really do without. But honestly, watching human life form, grow, and develop is miraculous.
Yeah.
And I started feeling like Neo in the Matrix. I'm like, you were once a baby, and you were once a baby, and you were once a baby. Like, we take for granted this thing that doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
You know, miscarriage is a thing.
Yeah.
It happens to a great majority of women, and we don't talk about it ever, you know? So every time you want to have a baby doesn't mean you necessarily can.
Right.
So when a child comes into this world, it's because it was meant to be here. Full stop. End of story. We don't need to discuss the context because that child had nothing to do with that context. It didn't get to choose how it got here and who it came through, but it's here now. So who's to say that they don't deserve to be here and live a full and beautiful life just as anybody would? So, you know, the experience of being a mom has also been really radicalizing for me. I mean, I've always been left of center. I come from a line of Black educators and organizers, people who were actually involved in the civil rights movement, people who sat next to the luminaries that we uplift every February, mm-hmm. right? Like, those are people in my family. So I've always had a certain amount of awareness of our history and our struggle and what's beautiful about us and what's powerful about us. But becoming a mom, there's just things, becoming a parent, there's just things that no one can tell you and it land the same way that it does when you're just in it, doing it, trying to keep someone else alive and trying to also hope they turn out well, you know, like not just the base level standard, but trying to raise a child who is proud of being a Black woman when she grows up,
right.
who knows where she comes from.
Right.
And who wants to make her ancestors proud.
Right.
You know, someone who isn't just in it for the individualism and isn't going to be just out here chasing a bag.
Right.
That's not what we're doing here.
Right.
You know? So that, those challenges to doing that well are the things that radicalize you and make you see, I shouldn't have to be doing this alone.
Right.
I shouldn't not have the resources to make this happen.
Right.
You know, and so I give huge thanks to the Play Cousins Collective. I give huge thanks to the Louisville Black Avant-Garde project stakeholders, the artists, families. I mean, every family member of every artist that I have done collections visits with has met my child and like probably held her at some point, you know?
Yeah.
And it felt like a family, and it feels like a family in the sense that I may not be with my former employer anymore, but I ain't dead. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm still here. I'm still talented. I'm still ready to do this work.
Right.
And so I have this really beautiful, genuine, authentic community of people who are like, yeah, let's do this work.
Yes.
Let's do this work.
Yes.
Because it's not about someone external to our community, an institution external to our community, coming in and calling the shots and saying, this is how this should go and this is how this story should be told. No, we're not doing that. Not in 2025, not when Breonna Taylor died for your sins. You know?
Right.
Because this project wouldn't have happened if she were just any other Black person living her life right now today. And that's that on that.
Yeah.
So, amen, ashe, praise God. God is good all the time. You know, we Absolutely. Have work to do.
Absolutely.
And we who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Like, roll up the sleeves.
Roll Let's them up, girl. Listen, now is not the time to be tired.
Right.
Now is not the time to be tired. Take a nap. Take a power nap.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? We got, what was it? It's a marathon. Nipsey. Come on.
Yes.
So what brings me joy is being in community with other smart and creative Black people such as yourself. Being in community with smart, creative people.
Yeah.
Who are kind and loving and genuine and who want what is right for humanity and for the earth and for our non-human kin, the plants and the animals and all that. We all deserve to be here.
Right.
We all have a right. And it takes all souls to make the world.
Absolutely.
So, I am thankful for the music, the visual art, the comedy.
Absolutely.
Girl.
There's that one thing we need right now is the laughter.
Listen, okay?
We need that.
Yes, I'm thankful for access to beautiful green spaces, to, you know, smell fresh air and yes. be underneath the trees. And yeah, so that's what brings me joy, is just being a real person and unplugging from the matrix and, you know, not, and just remembering the greater perspective.
Right.
Because we all can get bogged down into the everyday just survival mode of it all.
Right.
But what brings me joy is journaling, you know, and trying to be one with all that there is. Present. And trying to, you know, just be a good human yeah. in the world. And I take joy in that. And I like fighting, too. You know what I'm saying? Like, don't. That's why I'm like, now is not the time to be tired. Now is the time for, if you like a fight, let's come on. Take them earrings out, tie that hair up, and let's go. Let's go. We don't have time to be laying down. They are coming for us, honey.
Yeah.
And for all of life as we know it.
Right.
So, you know, now is the time. And so I love to see people fighting. I love to see people unionizing. I love to see mass protests. These things bring me joy, honey. Joy.
Yes.
Because I'm like, yes, I'm not crazy. I'm not alone. I'm not the only one who feels this way.
Yes.
So it just, you know, I love to see people in their power. So that's just.
The way you're speaking to my soul right now.
It's beautiful.
Absolutely.
And I like to read books. I like to read books. So, yeah.
Yes. I told you, well, we met at the library that one day. And just sitting in there complete, because I don't know what it is, but sometimes the stress that just can sit in the body and just, I woke up that morning in pain.
Right.
My back and neck was hurting. And then I'm sitting in the library. And of course, at first I'm like frantic. And then I take stock for a second about what my body is doing. I didn't feel the pain anymore. I was actually like breathing normally. And I could tell that everything was being recentered and recalibrated without me even trying.
Mm-hmm.
It was because I was in a peaceful space that feels like home.
Yes.
And that's what the library does for me. And the fact that it was only a like 5-minute drive from my house, we have that resource in our neighborhood that was gone for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And to have it back.
Shout out to the, what is it, the Park
Duval? The Parkland
Duval,
Branch.
Parkland
Library.
Branch. Thank you.
I love it so much. Just being, and I haven't even utilized it that much, but just knowing that I can go there at any point is just so.
Yeah, it gives a peace of mind.
Yes.
Same. So
it's also a liberatory space, and it just allows access to people who don't have access. And it just. I just love the library so
much.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, cheers to that, girl.
And you might, if we just
go ahead, let's
absolutely.
Do it.
Ding. Well, this is a nice rosé.
Not bad.
Absolutely.
For a little light drinker such as myself. Go ahead.
From our sponsors at the Wine Room.
Thank you, Wine Room.
But absolutely, thank you so much. Thank you for this conversation. I just felt like I'm also rooted in gratitude right now. And yes, so is there any other closing remarks that you'd like to make?
Please check out the show, Louisville's Black Avant-Garde, Gloucester Calamon Cox at the Speed Art Museum. They're free on Sundays. The catalog is in the gift shop.
Yes.
And the show comes down, I think, September 7th.
Okay.
So you still have time to go check it out.
And it's a wonderful show. I hope everybody goes to see it. I really want to go back myself and kind of just sit and experience it again, so hopefully I do. I know myself, so I need to put it on the calendar. But yes, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this conversation. This has been so healing for me as well.
I'm glad. Yes, we've been speaking to each other's spirits, so
the whole time.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Wheelhouse Arts Art by Volume, presented by The Wine Room by J. Bell Wine Co. and hosted by me, Robin Elise Gibson. Thank you so much for tuning in. And I'd also like to give a special thanks to our sponsors and wonderful guests. If you'd like to share any of your thoughts, comments, questions, or insights, send us an email to abv@wheelhouse.art. We'd love to hear from you. ABV is more than just a podcast. It's a celebration of creativity, expression, and the art that connects us all.